We're going on with our investigation, as we may say, of the idea of resurrection life. Last week we were talking a lot about the nature of persons. Might have sounded a little philosophical, maybe even scared some people away, but still, like I've said, if you don't understand the nature of an automobile, for example, it's more difficult to take care of it. We need to understand the nature of persons in the same way to help us sort out what is of value and what isn't. I think we see illustrations around us constantly of the tenuous nature of life, where you can be very high on the peak one day and down in the valley the next. I don't mean just an attitude. I mean your life has a way of pulling a rug out from under us. So you may be in perfect health one day, and next day you got a heart attack. You know, you never know what's going to happen. That's not to make us afraid. It's only to help us understand what it is we're all about. What's worth putting your life into and what isn't. On a secular basis, the freedom to develop who you are is important. People easily get locked into the system. Whatever creativity they have may be squelched by that. One person said to me, who was fairly much at the top of the ladder of success, as the world counts success, he said, I envy you your ability, your liberty to just be creative. And to write and to do the things. He said, I had ability in my field to be creative, but he said, I early got locked into the system and I can't really, no way to get out of it. But we're talking about what matters after all. I learned early in life, for example, that it costs money to be a big shot. So I've carefully shunned the trappings of the executive or the administrator or whatever, so you don't find a great office suite and gold letters on the door or on the desk or expensive suits or anything like that. And all the trappings that people look at and account successful are all, for the most part, phony anyway, and it just takes a lot of effort, energy, and money to maintain those trappings. Anyone who puts their effort into the trappings is, of course, missing the main point. The main point, as I've tried to tell you before, is the spirit within and not the flesh without, which is only trappings. At this place is a very talented, creative, and fairly well-known painter, artist, who, given the economy and given his desire to be free to paint, to work, drives an old beat-up Toyota and paints houses and so forth, and yet he is a very accomplished artist, you know. But, and some of his buddies who are accomplished artists, given the economy as it is, quit working, you know, they just stagnate. The point, of course, all of it is strictly that the maintenance of the external is not the way best to maintain the human person. Although there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having something to eat. Nothing wrong with, you know, with maintaining one's external also. There's nothing wrong with that. But the inner is the important thing. And if one were to spend all their time waxing the automobile and letting the engine deteriorate, it would be a very poor thing, right? So I think that says it all. Going back then, the resurrection factor, Paul has asked, what kind of a body are we going to have in the resurrection? He never answers the question. It would have been a splendid time for him to talk about mansions and about the trappings, material trappings. But he didn't. He chose the other route. He said, well, what is important is that the external is only the seed, and it's the inner quality of life that is important. The spirit, he says, there is a heavenly or a spiritual kind of life, and there's an earthly kind of life. The earthly kind of life is only like a seed. So don't worry too much about the external covering, because that has to die. Maybe on this earth, the biggest thing we come to learn is that we are nothing, as I've been saying to you before, that we are transient and temporal. The biggest thing that happens in our life may be the humiliation of us. That may be the biggest thing that happens in your life, is coming from thinking you're something to realizing that in the flesh, in the natural, we're all nothing. Maybe that's the important thing. And maybe every new blow that hits you, that takes some of the starch out of you, maybe what is necessary to teach you what you're all about. So you know that there's an engine in you. A lot of people don't know that. They don't know at all. They don't think at all about the spirit. There's a spirit to focus on. They think it's all the body. And they pour everything into it. And then down the life halfway, it all runs out. Of course, everything is so easy when we're young. In the early years, you can eat anything you want, and as much of it as you want, and not gain a whole lot of weight. Sad thing is that when we're building our lives in the beginning, the young years, when we should be doing the things or putting together the things that will hold us in good stead later, life is easy and nothing seems to matter. It's tempting to drift, not pay attention to what we're doing, decisions we're making, the life we're leading. And then all of a sudden, it matters when it's too late. See? Or a little late. Not ever maybe too late to get your head together, but not always. It's sometimes too late to put your earthly thing back together. So you may have to limp the rest of your life. It's most common. Perhaps all of us have a limp of some kind as a result of decisions made in the early days when life seemed easy and anything would do. And some of the mistakes we made then may have put a slight limp in us for the rest of our lives. But that's not too big a problem if you keep the spirit put together. You see, if you get that together, just like your old family sedan, you know, which may have a dent in the fender and the paint chipped here and there and maybe more dents than that. And yet, if you keep the thing running properly and you maintain it and so forth, it'll give you a lot of good miles anyway. So let's take people like myself and others, middle years plus. We got a lot of good years left of where the Spirit of God in us can make our lives productive and meaningful. That may not eliminate altogether the limp. Going back then to 1 Corinthians 15, we've discussed the whole point that the life on the earth is merely the external trappings that have not always much to do with the inner spirits. Yet on the other hand, Paul is saying that how you take care of that, it may make a difference. So you see, the seed in the ground, which is your present life, needs to be nourished, nurtured in spiritual matters, because the shell is not going to be very much. And you can take a seed, take one of the larger kinds of seeds, like an acorn, for example, and you could paint each acorn, perhaps even put a little face on it or carve it or whatever, make a nice, handsome little unit out of it in order to really make it nicer when you plant it. And it's not going to do anything for the tree, except maybe even prevent the thing from growing. Or you can put it on the sidewalk and it won't grow at all. You'll never get an oak tree out of a handsomely carved acorn sitting on the table. Strangely enough, and you may say, well, that's a pretty obvious truth. Is it so obvious? Then how come very few people follow it? How come people are so busy shaping up and carving and painting the acorn, rather than letting the processes which God has ordained for us, that is doing what He wants us to do, go ahead and bring the acorn into humiliation, if we may say, see? Nothing matters but what Christ wants out of your life. Nothing really matters beside that. And he wants the Spirit. You know, and if you want the best of both worlds, you're going to have trouble with that. If you want to paint up the acorn, it may never be much of an oak. You may have to come to humiliation. He has to take the starch out of us. You understand that? He has to take the starch out where we say, look, I'm nothing, Lord. I need your Spirit and I need you with me and I need to do what you want me to do in this life. But, you know, I talk to great numbers of people. There's always that subterranean stream that says, well, I know my Spirit's important, but I also have rights in this world. I have a right to happiness, or I have a right to possessions, or I have a right to this or that. And in the nature of the case, what the Bible is teaching you from one end to the other is you don't have any rights in terms of this world. You're a seed, and you're on this earth, your life comes to humiliation. That is, you come to be a simple peon or a seed out of which a spirit grows that is handsome to God. It may not be handsome to anybody else, but it's handsome to God. It's a life that he cherishes, though others may look at it and say it's not very much. But it's what he cherishes. How do you look to Christ? That's the only thing. Not how do you look to the world around you. How do you look to your family? Don't worry about whether your family likes what you are or not. It's not how you look to your family or to your friends or to the people around you or to yourself. How do you look to God? What does he want out of you? And that's all that matters. And it's all over so shortly. Now, if you catch that, then you catch what Paul is saying here in 1 Corinthians 15. Humiliation. If you've had things in your life that bring you down and make you feel a fool or are humbling to you and humiliating to you and so forth, or you don't seem to be going anywhere, ask yourself only this. What does Christ think of my spirit? How does he look at me? Now, none of us will ever really come out well in our own mind if we say, what does Christ think of me? We're always going to be putting ourselves down because, you know, it's just the nature of the case. We don't think the Lord really thinks a whole lot of it. If for his sake you are brought down, that is, you have not focused on things of this life for his sake, and you look a little seedy to the world around you, the old sedan looks battered, but the engine is good. That's what counts. That's what counts. Now go out and quit your job now so you can be humble. Don't humble yourself. Let God do it. He has ways of humbling you that you never dreamed of. So don't try it. If you do it yourself, you'll be grotesque. Let God do it. But don't shun that. Don't go for the gusto, you know. I mean, not for the gusto. You've got in this world, people go for the gusto. You go for what God thinks about your life and what he wants to do with it. He says in verse 42, so also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in strength. It is sown a fleshly body, it is raised a spiritual. Now the Greek word here is psychical. It is sown a psychical body. That is, our body is essentially psyche or brain, mind. That's the main thing of us, is the mind and the nervous system, the brain and the nervous system. You can lose limbs, you can lose a lot of your physical person, and it's the mind, of course, that carries the day and keeps you the same person. You can lose several limbs, in fact, and be completely distorted, but you're still the same person. In your psyche is the same psyche. Gets a little altered in the battering, but you are still basically the same person. But the psychical person here is the earthly element. all of our being, our body and our mind, everything, governed by the brain and the nervous system. And that's what he's talking about. It is sown a psychical being, it is raised a spiritual being.
It's safe to say the mind is really the shadow of the spirit, the reflection of the spirit. The mind is the earthly vehicle through which the spirit expresses itself.
Thus, when you are raised from the dead, or if you go without dying, our eternal state will be a spirit, which is the reality, and will be recognized, apparently from all evidences, including biblical evidences of the appearance of Jesus, for example, and others. Evidences today, if you can take with any grain of credibility, the kinds of things that are discussed today in terms of people who have been clinically dead at least and come back and so forth, and appearances and the whole weight of evidence through the centuries of human existence, including the Bible, indicate that the eternal state is one that is recognizable. And I suspect, although I'm not going to give you an absolute statement here, but I suspect that throughout eternity we will all be recognizable, and that the body and the mind we have is but a reflection of and a shadow of the reality, which is the spirit. But it will be possessed, the spirit will possess the same identities. You are an eternal identity. And whatever changes your body goes through, you're still the same spirit inside, and you are the perfection in Christ. We are, our spirits are the perfection of what God intends us to be. Just as Adam and Eve were created perfectly, but fell in their own choices, so we by our choices are also in the same position of continually limiting and in many ways abridging the perfections that God originally had intended for us to have. But in eternity, those perfections will be there, and our spirit, which is the essence of things, will be in evidence in all of its glory. That's why Paul says it is sown in corruption and raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. That is, the spirit housed by a limited body is continually confronted with frustration and dishonor. Dishonor because of our failures, our human weaknesses. But inside, the spirit is in its perfection. But it can't get out in the same perfection because it's limited by the physical and the human in us. So you're going to be raised in glory in the sense that you will be the fulfillment of all that God intended you to be as an individual. Now, I think that's a great thing. That ought to govern. That ought to govern how we live on the earth. It's just like, again, with the automobile. You're going to take a trip. I tend to be a little overprotective about people, but I'm always asking, do you have gasoline in your car? You're going to set out on the road. Have you got gasoline? Have you got money for gasoline? Have you got, are you all right? Have you got things taken care of? Yes, everything's fine. Okay, that's good. If a wife were to say to her husband now, have you got everything taken care of now? We're going on a trip. Car all set. Yeah, it's all fine. I took care of everything this morning. What did he do? He took it to the car wash and then he waxed it. And it was all set to go, but halfway down the road, they run out of gas. Well, I thought you took care of it. Well, I certainly polished it. I took all morning polishing the car, but that's not the important thing. You got gas in it. And what I'm saying ought to govern the fact that your spirit is the thing that's really to be cultivated. Are you making your preparations? Oh yeah, I've got everything going. I got a nice degree, and I've got a job, and I've got this and this and this, and I look very good. That's not the question. Are you ready inside? And I don't mean that you can ever be ready for Christ to come. I mean, is that what you're paying attention to? How often people make moves. I mean, for example, I sit down and talk to young couples before I perform the marriage. We have sometimes even 6 months of counseling periodically. So we'll have anywhere from 8 to 10 sessions together. And one of the things I constantly lay before them is this. Let Christ be in reality the head of your home, not just in theory. And that means if you're going to make a major move of any kind, consult him. Don't move just because externally it looks like it's an advancement or whatever. Just get the guidance of Christ in what you're doing. The tragedy is that over and over again, the very same young people that said, oh yes, 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 we know that. Yes, that's fine. That's exactly what we're going to do. And then they go out over and over again. They'll move here and there. They'll take this job and that job. And they get themselves into a pickle. And they come back, you know, we want some help now. Well, why did you move over there? Well, it was a better job and this and this and this. Nobody stops to say, when we move, are we going to have a place for fellowship? Are we going to be able to maintain our spirits? I say this over and over again to the young people who are counseling. Now, be sure Christ is leading you in your movements. Be sure this is something the Lord wants for your life. Oh, yeah, yeah, we know that already, see. And that's like, completely ignore it. Throw it to the winds. They want to be near mommy and daddy, or they want a better climate, or they get a little bit more money, or whatever. One of the biggest jokes is we want a better atmosphere to raise our children in. Well, I'll tell you something. I was born in a small town back in Arkansas, Siloam Springs. Hard to find it on a map. And I spent a number of years of my life in various settings that were not metropolitan. And I want to tell you that the young people in the rural sections are not any better than the ones in the city. And sometimes it's worse because they haven't got anything to do, so they dream up mischief. It's what you put into your young people, not what you put them in, that's going to make the difference. It's what you put into them, not the atmosphere you put them in, that's going to make the difference. Because you can't always help where your young people are going to be raised. There are a lot of very good, fine, stalwart Christian people that have to live in the ghettos. And they can't get out. They can't just say, oh, we like that opportunity there. It's only going to cost us $5,000 to move and set up our house over there, but we're going to go anyway because it's a better atmosphere. No, no, they get stuck right where they're at. Can't change it. What I'm saying is, it's no better in the rural areas than it is in the city. But people move for any reason. In fact, whatever Satan can do to get you to change whatever you're doing, especially if what you're doing is honoring to Christ or building your spirit, whatever Satan has to do to get you to change, he'll do it. He'll offer you more money. He'll give you anxiety about your present situation. He'll offer you a beautiful location. Satan can dream up more reasons than you can knock down why you want to move or why you want to change something. Because he wants to cut you out of the herd and get you out by yourself where he can work on you. So down the road, the only one thing you can do is say, Lord, I want to do what you want. Now, if you really mean that, you're not just kidding yourself, he'll find a way to see that you do it. I wouldn't put anybody on a treadmill that says you've got to be sure all the pieces are in place before you make a move. I don't know that we can do that. I think people may get too anxious in some situations and it becomes a burden. But if you'll just say to the Lord, I don't know whether we ought to move or not, but I'm asking you to help us here to make the right choice. See that we do what we're supposed to do. You pray about it. You seek counsel. You look to the Lord for guidance. And you then just do the best you can to make the move. And the Lord will come through and help you in one way or another to make the right choice if you honestly want to do what he wants. But we're going back again to the issue that it is sown in dishonor and raised in glory, saying to you that the thing to focus on is the Spirit. And you Fathers and husbands have an even greater responsibility to see that you don't mess around with your life and your families. Because the only thing your young people are going to have going for them is the spirit inside that'll hold them steady. If you're depending upon tying them to the bedpost to keep them steady, you're going to be in trouble. The spirit inside is what's going to hold them steady when they're in circumstances that they may not have the strength to overcome. They shouldn't be in those circumstances, but in the nature of life, they get into those situations. And only what you've put into them is going to make the difference. So whatever you do on the earth, it inclines to dishonor, that is to frustration, to the humiliation of the flesh. But if your focus is on the spirits, then you are maintaining your vessel with the right perspective. I've always said, if you're not certain, just stay still. Don't move until you're certain. When you can really say, as nearly as I can tell, this is what the Lord wants me to do, and I'm happy for you too. I'm not trying to just keep people back. I'm not just trying to make your life miserable. I'm trying to help you get that picture that you do with your life, your family, all the aspects of your life, what Christ wants you to do. Then you'll be paying attention to the spirit inside, to the engine, instead of to the body outside. And I don't say people shouldn't move here and there. I don't say they shouldn't take this job. I'm only saying be sure that the move is something that, as nearly as you can tell, is what Christ wants. Because anything else will lead only to frustration and distress and disappointment and all these other things. I'm speaking very bluntly, very plainly here, as I always have to, because I have responsibility for you in Christ, you see. The text here says it is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory, and everything to do with this earth leads to dishonor, except that which Christ wants you to do, which leads ultimately to the glorifying of your spirit. So it says then, the first man, Adam, became a living, the text there says a living soul. Well, you got to understand soul as meaning psyche in the sense of your brain and nervous system, plus the vehicle that carries it, which is your body, and expresses it. The brain is the most important thing, but without a body, the brain would have no organ of expression of what it thought. It'd be nice if we could do away with the body, but just not possible to eat, you know, if you only have a head, unless somebody feeds you. And then the last Adam became a life-giving spirit. Christ was a life-giving spirit. So Christ made up for what Adam could not do for us. Christ came as a life-giving spirit, and he has the power to make your spirit glorious. You see that? Christ has the power to make your spirit glorious, but you must put yourself in his hands to do it. He's the sculptor. And if you say, Lord, I want my life to be what you want it to be, he may take you through some deep water, through some mud holes, over some icy mountains. You may have here and there some difficulties, but the end will be glory. And in a sense, it's the difference between putting yourself in the hands of an accomplished mountaineer versus putting yourself in the hands of some tour guide or something if you're going to go over the Alps. The mountaineer will get you through. The tour guide may bring you to grief. Now, people in America and everywhere spend an awful lot of time tuned into charming tour guides. Now that may be not only in the religious realm, but also in the secular realm. Everybody has an axe to grind. Everybody wants a piece of the action, wants a piece of you, whether they're selling you cosmetics or whatever. Everybody has an axe to grind. They want a piece of you. They may be ever so charming and debonair and all the rest of it, but what they're after is a piece of you. They're like the tour guides. If you want to get over the mountain, you've got to trust Christ with your life. And do what He wants you to do, because He'll get you through. If you follow that principle, you'll make it. Even if you may feel you're not very spiritual and not very much able to make choices, He'll help you with that. But just be at peace, relax, put yourself in the Lord's hands, say, Lord, what I want here is not what I like, but what you want. And in the end, He'll bring you to glory, to the top of the mountain, in one piece, which is important.